Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus. Hey, tonight we're studying Proverbs 29. In the same way that Deuteronomy is a repetition of the laws of Exodus and Leviticus, Proverbs 29 harkens back to many of the statements we've learned throughout the book of Proverbs. It is a Deuteronomic response. It is a repetition of old stories, but amplified a little, so that it's not just a carbon copy. It's not cut and paste, but it is a few words that remind you of something from before with additional commentary, additional application, or an additional example. And I think this is going to be really useful tonight. So let's read Proverbs 29. You recognize a lot of these warnings, don't you, as we read this? You recognize the cautions about harlots or about fast speech, that is, speaking before you hear the full question, about flattery and about folly and anger. These are repeated. Why do you reckon it repeats so often? Okay, so repetition reinforces the information, giving it a stature of importance. Okay, what else? How about we forget? We're pretty dull of hearing. You know, there's, yeah, I've heard that song before. I forgot what it meant. I forgot that. We get so distracted in these days, much more so than in those days. In Bible days, they didn't have as much stimulus. They didn't have as many advertisements on their televisions. They were limited in those days. And they didn't have as many signs in every neighborhood through which they traveled, in every airport. They simply got along in life, and they didn't have that much data to process. I'm not saying they were more foolish. I'm saying they had a simpler life. And because of that, they didn't have as many distractions. For us, who have both the distractions of modern world and the difficulty of forgetting, maybe the Proverbs are even more important than what they were to the men and women in those days. If they needed to hear it over and over, boy do we. And so I'm glad for those people who read these chapters every day. That is, today's the 29th, and you read the 29th chapter. And tomorrow's the 30th, so you read the 30th. You get the idea. Well, let's unpack these one by one. Whoever, a man who hardens his neck after much reproof, will suddenly be broken beyond remedy. He is moving towards hopelessness. Why? What's wrong with him? He's been reproved. He's been corrected. He's been challenged to amend his ways. Not once, not twice, but over several times, the Bible says, after much reproof. And he hardens his neck. What a picture, isn't it? Harden your heart, I can understand. What does harden your neck mean? Why does it use that image? What's a stiff neck? Why neck? Why not stiff arm? Why not stiff nose? What is a stiff neck? Okay, the head is up. Always. See, the neck is stiff. It will not bend. It will not humble itself. Posture really means a lot in Bible. There are those people. I had quite an argument with a woman who rang yesterday, and she was Seventh-day Baptist. Right after, we had a staff meeting on Tuesday, and we knocked that around, the difference between Seventh-day Baptist, Seventh-day Adventist, on and on. And some of the SDB can be a little more fierce about Sabbath. Well, this woman, who's not in fellowship, wanted to tell me that I was wrong for going to church on Sunday. I said, frankly, ma'am, I'd rather be in a place together with believers on Sunday than not be in a place like you're not going because you believe in Saturday and won't go anywhere. I'd rather be with people than not be with people, bottom line. Well, she was a little fierce, and her neck was pretty stiff. It was unrelenting, unyielding, and you're right, her head was up, wouldn't bow, etc. Well, she wanted to make a big point about the Sabbath and worshiping on the Sabbath. I said, I'm sorry, I've never seen it once in the Bible, I could be wrong, but I've never seen it once where Sabbath and worship are said in the same sentence. I'm happy to see it, but I've never seen it. And she said, well, what else do you do? And I said, well, is that all you do on the Sabbath is worship, or do you also read the newspaper, or do you take a walk with your husband? There were all these things that were reasons for her to stiffen her neck. And I thought, that's just not useful. She should be moldable. She should bow her neck. She should humble herself. Because when you really think about worship, you're not thinking about singing songs. I hope you never think like that. I mean, that's praise. That's thanksgiving. That's good stuff. But the Bible use of the term worship is always associated with one idea. You know what it is? Bowing. I will bow down and worship. I humbled myself. Bowing down is worshiping the Almighty. It is silent. Or we should say, not necessarily communicating. But it's physically a response of humility. In a response to the Almighty. That is worship. So you see, genuflecting, I don't have any problem with people who do that kneeling and crossing themselves and all that. If they think that gets them closer to God, I don't know that it does. But it's a humility thing that I think is good. Bowing. You know, in the synagogue, the Shaliach Tzibur, the representative of the congregation, bows down one time. Physically, face on the ground, one time a year. Yom Kippur, at night. Yeah, he literally bows down, face on the ground. Very scary. Maybe it was daytime, Yom Kippur. But it was always very impressive to me that he would do that. There were minimal rockings and sort of bowings, kind of forward leanings during the Shemoneh Esrei and during the Tachanun, but they were minimal. This was extreme worship, the new sport. And I always appreciated that, though it was a little off-putting. So here it is, the man who hardens his neck after much reproof, gets lots of chances, will eventually get broken. Unfixably broken. Why? Because the very thing that will fix him is the humility that he needed to bow and not be stiff-necked. That echoes so much of Solomon's words to his son, receive my sayings, treasure my commandments within you, listen to the words of your father, don't reject the teachings of your mother, on and on. You get the idea. Then there's these governmental thoughts in verse 2, and we see it again in verse 4, and we see it again later on. When the righteous increase, the people rejoice. When a wicked man rules, people groan. This is so black and white, isn't it? It's so dichotomous. We're looking and we say, people happy, yay! People sad, whoa! It's a little like a live television broadcast. People in righteous increase, good. Wicked rule, bad. Well, the opposites don't seem to be so evident here. Righteous increase, people rejoice. What's the opposite? Righteous decrease. So it's a volume, a number, a quantity. Or we could say, when the righteous increase, people rejoice. When the wicked increase, people are sad. But it doesn't contrast the number of governed with the number governed, or with the righteous or wickedness of the people, but rather with the people versus the sovereign. Really clever. I think it's clever. So wicked increase, it's good. Wicked increase, and it only takes one if he's the governor, if he's the mayor. Look, we've got a problem in New South Wales right now. You know that, with bless her heart, Belinda Neal. Right, you've now looked at this, you've studied this, you've followed it along. The Iguana Bar and Grill, whatever it is, up in Gosford Way. And Belinda, our Member of Parliament, who, federal MP, who went in there with her husband, John Della Rocca, and they were bullying. Basically, they were bullying the staff at the Iguana Hotel and Pub. Later, when confronted by many of the staff, they said, no, we didn't do that. And now it's come out from a current affair a couple nights ago that Ms. Neal asked her offsider, her new assistant, who'd only been working for 3 weeks, to please amend your statement to the police.
Oh, the apology or something.
Well, the apology is another thing. The apology was one that Della Rocca wrote to the hotel and said, this is what I'm expecting you to send. And then he, Della Rocca, sent that to Morris Yemma and said, see, here's what they're going to be sending. Yemma thought they had already sent it, but it came from the education minister's fax machine as a recommended. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of dirt coming out here. There was the activity that night. There's the statement to the press. There's the statement to the police. There's the behavior in bullying even her new staff and the staff member's husband. They said, please don't put down the bottle of wine that we've had as far as your statement goes. So there's a lot of dirt going on. I want to say, when the wicked rules, people groan. And you know that. Every time that government does something really bad, you go, oh. Isn't it? It's like a groan, isn't it? Oh, pff, give me a break. Whoever it is. Look, when they raise the taxes, or when they say, we've tried everything, and then, okay, the Saudi Arabian government said 1 month ago at an OPEC meeting that they've done everything they can and they are producing all the oil they can, crude oil. 1 month later, oh yeah, we'll be producing 700,000 gallons more a day. Wait a minute, where'd you find it? Obviously, they were not being as forthcoming as they should have a month ago. So now they're doing that. Well, now they've come up with another statement now within the last couple days. And so every time they do these things, you groan. The Bible is true, isn't it? The Bible is true. And what he's comparing now is wicked men ruling and righteous men ruling. But he uses it in terms of righteous increasing. And if we rule, good on us, you know. Now, there's a lot of controversy going on right now in the United States about Barack Obama courting the evangelical vote. It's a big block of American Republican, mostly, but in this year, who knows what'll happen. And Obama, it has been revealed in a speech 2 years ago in Washington, D.C., said all kinds of things about the Sermon on the Mount and about the Book of Leviticus, and we're beyond that now, and on and on. And he basically is not giving the evangelicals much platform on which to stand with him. All this, and he's taking some real Mickey out of all. Of some people, including, and you don't do this, Dr. James Dobson, head of Focus on the Family, who is one of the most respected clinical psychologists who lives really to serve children and families, and he's a wonderful guy. Well, Obama took him on in this speech and said, look, if he was using a binary approach to interpreting Bible, you could have Al Sharpton, who's also a minister, or Jim Dobson, who's going to really interpret it for us? And his whole bottom line was, let's be broader. Obama's sentiment in the speech was, we need each other. But he didn't exactly say it in those lines that I've read that have been culled from this 2006 speech. when the righteous increase, the people rejoice. And if the righteous are trying to increase, they want to rejoice behind a leader who will give them platform and who will lead us not astray, but lead us well. So that's why I say, it says in verse 2, when the righteous increase, the people rejoice. When the righteous increase in their station, in ruling and in governance. Well, I'm watching this news magazine show this morning, and the Christian woman who is the presenter is interviewing several people, including this minister and that minister and somebody from Focus on the Family, etc. And she says, and I think very well, look, evangelicals are not going to be happy with anybody in this election. Maybe it's time for evangelicals to get back to what they're supposed to be doing, evangelizing. And I thought, whoo-hoo, you know, good on you, lass. Well, obviously, it would be nice if evangelicals and religious concerned conservatives could have a voice in a political manner. I'm happy with that. But she's right. If there's no room at the inn, let's get back to the business we're supposed to be in. Again, but that reflects, verse 2 reflects an awful lot of the governance and good government that we looked at in chapters earlier. Verse 3, a man who loves wisdom makes his father glad, but he who keeps company with harlots, you want to say, makes his father sad. The contrast should be much more parallel, but it doesn't do that. A man who loves wisdom doesn't hang out with harlots. You see, there's a if A, then B. If B, then not A. It seems like it should work like that. But he widens it than the standard issue proverb. I think Solomon is widening it for us, and usefully, so that we can get other ideas instead of just a simple, singular understanding. A man who loves wisdom makes his pop smile. And I like that. When my son turned 29 the other day, and we had a party, a family gathering for him. My daughter turns 18 next week, and there's going to be a serious party somewhere, I imagine. And I will drain my wallet, and I will be happy. What makes me the happiest is when they love wisdom. And when we have great discussions about philosophy and truth and good stuff about not just mental things, but sociological things. And I can see that they're trying to love wisdom. So it thrills me as a daddy to have my children participating in wisdom and knowledge, getting academic degrees, considering eternity, considering philosophies, where they're not just going to the footy and getting drunk and dismissing friendships, but they're really considering a bigger picture. And that is exactly what Solomon says here. But if you go out and keep company with hookers, you're going to waste your wealth. Yeah, we saw that earlier too. King gives stability to the land by justice, but a man who takes bribes overthrows it, or gives instability. Do you see the parallel? Gives instability to the land. Injustice is as off-putting to a land and to the people as bribe-taking by a king or by anyone. If you want, you know how sad it is when you read about judges who do wrong? You think, judges? They're role models. Judges, they uphold justice. If they do wrong, what hope do we have? And we've seen an increasing number of justices acting unjustly, both in Australia and globally. The most horrible, the most heinous of these that's happening right now is not a judge, but a president in Zimbabwe, who after a perfectly reasonable election said, nah, that didn't count. Let's try that again. And then issues threats and bullies his opponent into resigning. So the election will be forthcoming this weekend, and gee, I wonder who will win. Well, when that happens, the people moan and groan, and a man who takes bribes overthrows a land by injustice. Do you see how that works? Overthrowing the land. So there's no stability in the land, even though he will attempt to say, now it's all calm. Anybody who knows anything about Rhodesia knows that it used to be much calmer until it became Zimbabwe. And Mugabe, who's in his 70s now, isn't he, is no good for that land. It's just a shame. I don't think ever. You know, he took over old farms, and it's just been a continued injustice. Verse 5, a man who flatters his neighbor is spreading a net for his, we'll say, own steps. You think you're getting yourself a good place. Doesn't flattery do that? We've studied that before. Flattery gets you into good positions. Oh, Mr. Johnson, you're the most wonderful man.
Oh, come here, son.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Johnson. May I get something? You are, may I say, you're just, you know, a wonderful speaker. And may I say, Mr. Johnson, the way you dress, it's impeccable. And the more we do that, the more we spread a net to trap ourselves. Because we're looking in the wrong places. That's what he said earlier in the Proverbs, that we've got our eyes off focus, and we will get trapped and trip over the spaghetti of other nets that other people lay for us. But it's really our doing, not their doing. An evil man is ensnared by transgression, but the righteous sings and rejoices. In other words, is not ensnared. You see, we're looking at the widening of the proverb. It's not just singular. An evil man is ensnared by transgression. A righteous man is not ensnared, but rather sings. So he has the benefit of both not being trapped and of being happy. So flattery is not going to trap the guy who's receiving it. That also happens. But in this case, I think it's coming back on the flatterer. This is bad news for the flatterer. In 5. Verse 7 is a little more singular in its width here. The righteous concern for the rights of the poor. The wicked doesn't understand such concern. So he not only doesn't understand, he's not concerned. There's two things happening. And the wicked man, why doesn't he understand the concern? Why doesn't a wicked man understand the concern for the rights of the poor? Okay, no empathy. What'd you say?
No.
That's right. He's not looking outward. He's looking inward. He's not looking to extend the borders of God's kingdom to others. He's looking to receive all the benefits he can. So when he sees somebody who's compassionate, and you see this all the time, don't you? Somebody walking by a fella. Look, the windscreen wipers. The windscreen cleaners in cars. And there are people who will not let the windscreen boys do their thing. Okay. But then there are those who get mad. I've heard them on Talkback Radio. Why do we let those people out there at Moore Park and, you know, wherever, all these places? They shouldn't be there. And you hear a genuine disparaging of the poor. It's a genuine, I mean, they're out working. They're trying to get a dollar or something. You know, they're not sitting there begging. Good on them for trying. Like the people who sell the big issues. Good on them for trying. You know, everybody who's out there. Well, but even if they're not trying, the wicked has no compassion because he's only looking out for himself. He has no worldview. He only has his worldview. Verse 8, scorners set a city aflame, but wise men turn away anger. Scorner. What's a scorner? Mocker, ridiculer. And so the city gets burned up because mockery keeps spreading around. And yesterday, I thought that the Speaker of the House in New South Wales did a great thing. Did you hear about this? In light of the iguana event, about which we spoke earlier, a member of parliament, lower house here in Sydney, came in, and when Mr. Yema was asked a question about the iguana gate, this member of lower house parliament had a, not a pet, but a stuffed animal iguana, and put it on his back, and obviously was taking the Mickey out of the Labour government and all. Well, the speaker wouldn't have anything to do with that and threw the guy out of the chambers. Good on him. Good on him for doing that. It's bad enough. Mockery is bad. He shouldn't have done that. That's really juvenile. Scorners set the city aflame. And he wasn't going to have anybody scorning Ms. Neal and the whole iguana gate. It's okay to call it as an unjust activity, but don't demean it and put it on juvenile level. Say it was wrong. Say anything. Wise men turn away anger. That's good. Turn away anger both from themselves by speaking calmly and from others by not interacting with it. Well, verse 9 was one that I remember from my own testimony. In 1971, I was a hippie and hitchhiking around the United States, and I was confronted in Atlanta, Georgia, on Peachtree Street, near all the where all the hippies hung out, by four, I'm sure they were Southern Baptists, American, in their skinny ties and white shirts and crew cuts. They looked scary. I mean, mind you, we were a whole colony of hippies in our long hair and tie-dye and beads and shoelessness, and these guys were impeccable and looked kind of like scary Southern Baptists. Anyway, they confronted me with my sin, and they told me to turn or burn. I mean, a horrible thing to say. They told me that Jesus was the Savior and that I was going to hell, on and on. And all I remember from that event of my reaction was that I laughed my head off at them. And I raged at them. Now look at verse 9. When a wise man has a controversy with a fool, the fool either rages or laughs, and there is no peace. It's not the word shalom, it's the word noach, to rest. Uh-huh. I did not have peace. I raged and I laughed at these guys. And I was, when I saw this later, I saw that I was the fool. And that they were, alright, they were a little unusual in their demeanor, in their manner, in their dress, in everything they said. However, I was the fool. And I saw that and still regret my behavior that day. But you'll see that often in your relationships. My wife challenged me the other day about something. Why do you do that? And I started laughing. And it was that embarrassed kind of, oh, caught out laughter. And I realized this verse was true again. And my wife was the righteous and I was the foolish. Verse 10 is a reflection of many other bloodshed and blameless verses from earlier. And the upright are concerned for his life. Men of bloodshed hate the blameless, but the upright are concerned for, we'll say, the life of the blameless. So there's hatred or concern. Again, the same kind of reflection as we saw earlier in verse 7. Verse 11 is a repeat of 9. And verse 12, again, a reflection about rulership and making sure that ministers in government are being kosher. Verse 13 is beautiful about the realities of opportunities for all people. God gives common wisdom, common grace, common love to all people, doesn't he? We see here the poor man and the oppressor have this in common. The Lord gives light to the eyes of both. It's called common grace. And it is that which characterizes the Almighty. Aren't you glad for that? Whether it's Mugabe or the people in Zimbabwe, whether it's those Southern Baptists or me in that story, whether it's the people in your neighborhood or at your workplace or on the train with you, you all have the same opportunities to respond to the love of God. And you've responded, so now you get to extend that kind of opportunity to others. What a beautiful picture of common grace. People will argue with you about your religion and say, well, yeah, but you, what about the Aborigines in the Northern Territory? What about the Ooga Booga tribe in the Congo who've never heard about the religion that you espouse? Or the folks in Irianjaya or on some island between there and Guam who've never heard the gospel of your Jesus? You say, well, you know what's fascinating is there's common grace. God extends favor to all people. And according to Romans 1, he has shown us that in creation. And that is visible to all mankind. There's not a person on the planet who hasn't experienced some level of creation. And therefore, they have opportunity to know that there is a creator. That's wonderful. Common grace. I can't get away from that. And you don't want to. Verse 14 is about establishing the throne. And verse 15, now we pick up a child who gets his own way. So there's the establishment of the throne at home. The rod and reproof give wisdom. But a child who gets his own way, in contrast to getting a rod, brings shame to his mother. Who else does he bring shame to? His father, yeah. And what about himself? What about his family? What about his neighborhood? You know. But for some reason, mom is picked on as being the one who's most embarrassed. Why do you reckon? The father is generally more strict, or stricter. The mother is usually more lenient. So if a child uses the mother love to get his own way, then it shames the one who allowed it to fall out that way. Wicked increasing, not a good day. Righteous see their fall. Please, let it happen. Verse 16, maybe something about Solomon and good government. And as you read the words of Solomon, you need to reflect on when he wrote these and the possibility that he's even writing some of these as his sons are trying to take over in his house, and as he anticipates the ruin that the Jeroboam-Rehoboam argument will entail. Verse 17, correct your son, he'll give you comfort. Again, that word Noah, like Nahum the prophet, like Noah the ark builder, not the word shalom. He'll give you comfort. He'll also delight your soul. This is an expansion, not a parallelism. If you do this, that'll happen, but if you don't, that won't. So that's a parallelism. Here we see, correct your son, you get A, and you get B. Woohoo! It's a bigger, great story. Verse 18, again, like we saw in the last couple weeks, keeping the law is not Torah observance. Though it's the same Hebrew word, Torah. What it's saying is, when there's no sight of what's ahead, people go nuts. But happy is the one who doesn't go nuts. So in other words, you have to have a vision, you have to have a plan, you have to have a program in which you participate. And that's not just talking about Torah, it's talking about a plan for your life. Talking about what your father and mother have laid out for you, what your government has laid out for you, including compassion for the poor and not living in falsehood. All these things that he's talking about, from your rod and reproof in your youth up until you die, these are all good long-range plans. And if you've got that vision to live a holy life and a good life, then you're going to be restrained by what? By the vision. And the vision, he says, is similar to Torah. That's all that means.
It's like instruction.
Instruction, that's right. It's not talking about the five books of Moses. It's talking about the instructions you've been receiving and continue to receive. Yeah. And verse 19 even shows it. A slave will not be instructed by words alone. It takes more than that. though he understands, there's no response. Verse 20, you see a man who's hasty in his words? More hope for a fool than for him. Earlier we saw, when there's an abundance of words, transgression is unavoidable. Earlier we saw that when there's an abundance of words, transgression is unavoidable. When there's an abundance of words, transgression. So, keep your mouth closed. The last thing you want to do is prove to everybody how little you know. It's one thing when they think you don't know anything. It's another thing when you speak and validate it. Don't do that. Don't you like it when you're in certain meetings and there's a fellow who's been sitting there or a woman who's been sitting there and they don't say anything very much, but when they do, you take it on board because it's really good. Their batting average goes up and you tend to think that in other situations they'll probably know something as well. Verse 21 says, take care of your slave and he'll take care of you in due course, doesn't it? Basically, pamper, that's not a bad word in the Bible. It doesn't mean overindulging. It means treating him like a child, like one of your own. And in the end, you'll find him to be one. There's so many myths and fables of people who have treated, you know, the wolf who lives with the family and grows up and becomes like the family. Or the person who grows up with the wolves who becomes like the wolf. You become like that which you're surrounded. There was a famous story of what's called the face. And this man felt himself very ugly. And he put on a mask every day lest people see him in his ugliness. And when he married, his wife wanted to see him for real. He said, oh, no, you can't. And at the end of the tale, he takes off the mask and he has become what the mask was. A beautiful picture of that very thing. Take care of a slave, make him as if he's your son when he's on his wedding day, you know, in the end. He will be what you want him to be. Now look, I think of that in various ways. I'm not very good at X or Y or Z. And if I trust God in that area and I put my mask on and live in that way, I'm not saying pretend, I'm just saying live up to the standard that requires. So let's say you're not very loving. So you go ahead and give it a go and try. It's inordinate and you're affected in your affection towards other people. But at least you're giving it a go. In due course, you become like that mask. You become like the very thing you've sought. I like that and want to live there. Look, when Yeshua says, be holy as I'm holy, you think, am I ever going to get there? Or when the Apostle Paul says, put on the new man with its forgiveness and kindness and all these things, you think, how am I going to do that? It's just a put on. No, it's a mask. It's something that I'm clothing myself in, that I say, that's my faith. I want to be there. And then in the end, we'll be like him. It's not pretension. It's not pretending to be nice. It's saying, Lord, here's my faith. I'm going to act as if I'm kind and gentle and all these forgiving and generous, humble. I'm going to act like that in faith that will become the real me in due course. Verse 23 says that if you've got pride, it's going to bring you down, but a humble spirit, you're going to win. You're going to get this thing. And so verse 25, bottom line, Herdat Adam yitain mokesh. The fear of Adam brings a snare. This is not the fear of Ish, a man, but the fear of all men. This is the fear of the human race. We discussed the fear of man earlier in Proverbs as this inordinate desire to be approved by people. And that won't help anybody. We have no idea what's really a motivator inside a movie star. We we know them as their characters, and we know them as actors who try to market their films when they come through Australia, or we see them on interviews, and we know what they, how they respond to paparazzi, according to the media, but we don't know them unless we've sat down with them. And the ancient Greeks used masks for happy and sad, and you see those as the marks of a thespian. That is, yeah. In fact, the word hypocrite means a masked one, one who wore a mask, and it was a drama term. Yeah, that makes sense if you stay in it too long, or it's a bad production, or a evil character you play, you could become like that evil character. If I sought the pleasure of men, I would not be pleasing God. Galatians 1:10. So for Paul, in this letter to the Galatians 1:10, he's saying, I've got a choice in life whether to be a man pleaser or a God pleaser. In the words of the Proverbs, I could be a man-fearer or a God-fearer. At the end of the day, who is the one from whom I solicit pleasure or solicit approval? If it's God, good on you. If it's man, meaning mankind, not any particular man, then you're going to lose. That is so cut and dried. It's so binary, and it's so right. You got to have a healthy self-respect so that you couldn't care less what other people said, because you care more about what God says and who He is in your life. You think it makes sense for me to wear a t-shirt that says Jews for Jesus? You think it makes sense for people who want to be approved by other people to speak about Jesus to others? Generally, no. If you want to be a herald of approval in this country, speak about beer and wine and fun and footy. Yeah, he's a great guy. I love that, Bob. You know, Bob, he's always spinning a yarn about some good old boy he knows who's just a fun lover. Yeah, I love that, Bob. Yeah, no, I don't like that, Bob. You know, he's always talking about Jesus. You know, I don't like that, Bob. He's always got this righteous thing he's trying to live in. That, like that mask he wears. You know, and at the end of the day, I'm not always talking about Jesus, but I'm always trying to live in such a way that He's honored in my life. And that's, at the end of the day, going to make me and Him happy. I'd rather be there than being good old Bob. The fear of man brings a snare, but the opposite, he who trusts in the Lord will be exalted. You want the benefit, you want to be exalted in the midst of people, you could be so enamored by them and seeking their approval that you could seek for it and never get it. I love the words in chapter 23 about the riches making themselves wings and flying away. The thing you seek, you're right there, and it's just gone. It's like a mirage, gone. But here, the fear of man, it's going to bring a snare. It's going to trap you. But if you want to be out of that trap, trust in the Lord. Simply put, verse 27, unjust man, hateful to the righteous. Upright in the way, hateful to the wicked. How simple, how black and white. Where do you want to be? With whom do you want to stand? The righteous or the wicked? The Almighty or mankind? Good kings or bad kings? The favored and to whom we give flattery, or to the poor and to the oppressed? Let's have concern for the things that concerns God, and I think we'll do well. You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact us at Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you. Thank you.